This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right. They're coming. The rats are coming. Thousands of them.
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait. There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Experimental science by a man whose abnormal passions inspired him to try the impossible.
I brought her back. She'll live and I'll get her another body.
Yes. What of her soul? How can you make of her an experiment of horror?
His mad ambitions and desires threaten every woman possessing an attractive body. Girls whose measurements make them beauty contest participants. Professional figure models such as this. All are prey to his distorted desires.
What's left behind that door?
Horror. No normal mind can imagine. Something even more terrible than you.
Horror has its ultimate. And I'm that.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's the brain that wouldn't die.
And this is a story of Bill and Jan, two star-crossed lovers, one's head is in a pen.
Now, you may be mistaken for thinking that's John Cougar Mellencamp, but that's actually our very own Jeff from the Really Awful Movies podcast.
Who's way better than John Cougar Mellencamp.
Inimitable singing style.
Yes, indeed. I mean, look, this is not American Idol. I mean, this is the Really Awful Movies podcast, and this is The Brain That Wouldn't Die from 1962. Now, this is ostensibly a B-movie schlocker. I mean, this movie was lambasted on Mystery Science Theater 3000. This is a movie that is an iconic movie poster. Mm-hmm. You see the head in the pan on t-shirts and whatnot. But it says this movie does ask some questions that were sort of germane to the time, as well as sort of philosophical. Mm-hmm. But of course, at the same time, it is sort of just a schlocky movie, and it's got a bit of everything. So, I mean, it's interesting because this film came out in 1962. Frankenstein, the James Whale classic, came out in 1931. So 31 years later, okay? Now, you got to think, when Frankenstein came out in 31, the medical science was only about 30-odd years removed from, like, you know, bloodletting and leeches and all these weird cures that they thought would, you know, mm-hmm. cure the human body of whatever ailment. Now, here we have Frankenstein. Now, based on the Mary Shelley novel, the Mary Shelley novel was way more than a monster. I mean, it couldn't really be more different than the film adaptation. It was really a treatise on philosophy, morality, playing God. I mean, in Will's film, there was a scene that was cut in the States, a line actually deemed blasphemous by the censors, where after Dr. Frankenstein, Colin Clive's wonderful character, gives birth to the monster, and he goes, it's alive, and he goes, by God, now I know what it feels like to be a god. And that was cut out because it was blasphemous. But I mean,
wow.
This has always been a question, you know, where does science end and religion begin, or vice versa? Where does religion end and science begin? To this day, we have debates, you know, creationism versus natural design, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It boggles
natural
my mind.
Natural selection. And then the Scopes monkey trial, and
it boggles my mind that in 2016, people still, you know, I mean, I'm not going to, okay.
Well,
I don't
about 3.5 decades after this, the Beatles were more popular than Jesus, and look what happened there. So it took a long time.
But the reality is that in 1962, a movie was made that was definitely in debt to Frankenstein. It's a mad scientist movie.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a little bit of a difference in the sense that, you know, we did not get the inner monologue of Boris Karloff as Frankenstein, especially when he's being stitched together. Whereas in this movie, we get the inner monologue of Jan, who's basically just a head being kept alive in a pan full of, they gave it a name, but like some sort of amniotic fluid.
The tubes going into it.
Test tubes going into her. And, I mean, we should backtrack a bit. When this movie begins,
there's... Jan and her paramour, Dr. Kottner, and you know he's I described him as Paul Newman-esque. Mm-hmm. He's this kind of tall, suave, debonair. They don't exactly say what kind of surgeon he is, but I guess he's a neurosurgeon.
Well, he's in the operating room with his father,
mm-hmm.
and his father is, I guess, from the old school, and they lose someone on the table. And
or do they?
Well,
dun, dun, dun.
they do, because then
but
says,
the son has new methods.
Yeah, the son says, okay, you've lost him, now let me go to work. And the father goes, the operating room is no place to experiment. He's dead. Bill says, so he's dead, I can't do no harm. Okay, the corpse is yours. And Bill...
Yeah, do no harm, Hippocratic oath. So he says, okay, go to it. And through some weird sort of fake...
Brain operation.
He somehow manages through some sort of means to resuscitate this.
The stiff.
Yeah.
And
the pulse gets going, and
then,
I guess the pop says, okay, I'll concede this one to you. This was pretty great.
Well, when he said no, he was not.
But with a caveat, watch out, do this.
He actually says, I may not approve of your methods, but I'm proud of your results.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you did it, you saved a life, but was it right, you know?
Yes.
Yet again, I mean, you didn't go by, you know,
the
preordained rules of medical science. You did something different, and you saved a life, but are we meant to go this far, quote-unquote, ahead
mm-hmm.
in science? Now, Bill...
His retort is, there's more to being a surgeon than just being a carpenter, just like cobbling different things together. So he obviously has a god complex,
as
he said before.
Indeed, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he's hooked up with this woman named Jan, and he's taking her out for a ride.
Well, yeah, they're racing because Bill gets a call saying he has to go to one Dr. Kurt's house, Toot Sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're racing down the freeway, they're involved in a car accident. And Bill seems to emerge from the car accident completely unscathed.
Yeah. And yet the car is totaled and lying in a ravine somewhere.
Yep. And he goes to the flaming wreckage and he pulls a bundle out of the car, and it's the head of his paramour.
This was lost on me. So you actually said, no, that's her head. And I felt stupid. But anyway, he did procure her noggin from the vehicle and
mm-hmm.
take it up and wrap it in swaddling cloth or whatever he did, stick it under his arm and take it back to his lab.
Well, yeah, and this is where the aforementioned Dr. Kurt also works. Now, Kurt is not only a colleague, it's like sort of like, you know, I'm not just a hair club for men president, I'm also the client.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just a colleague, he's also a patient, because he was experimented on by Bill, who did something to his arm. But it resulted in some weird mutation. Like, I mean, Dr. Kurt's arm is not...
Yeah, I guess he's got some sort of hand transplant.
Mm-hmm.
And the hand is all monstrous.
Yeah,
and deformed and
disgusting.
And this came around the time when, I guess, the first reattached limb surgery was being done in the 50s. So this would have been just nouveau, as opposed to, like, Frankenstein, where they're just... you know, imagining this to be. So this had just happened.
Yeah.
And he's got this, I'm a freak of nature. He's got this hand that's all bent out of
mm-hmm.
shape and misformed and misshapen.
But the hope is that if Bill can continue experimenting and perfect his transplantation techniques, and now what he wants to do is take his lover Jan's head and affix it to a perfect body. Mind you, only has 48 hours to do that.
Yes.
Then he can, you know, perfect his technique and then do the same for his colleague, Dr. Friend's arm. Now, So we mentioned earlier that, I mean, this is so iconic. I mean, everyone's seen this picture of this head in the pan, wrapped in gauze, and, you know, affixed all these test tubes and blood being pumped into it and a pan full of fluid.
Yeah.
And, but what's very interesting is as soon as Jan opens up her eyes, what's the first words out of her mouth? Kill me.
Yes.
Kill me. You know, she doesn't want to just be a head. And then they have a bit of a philosophical discussion. I mean, yes, you save her brain, but what about her heart?
Yeah.
What about her soul? Where is that? You know, what do you have going on here, you know? And yeah. So there's that. I mean, there is a bit of philosophy, morality. There's a lot of exposition in this
movie. And the question, what would you rather be, paralyzed or dead? Or just kind of insulting, but a question she could very well be... a source to answer, because she is a head, and let's say you're Stephen Hawking or something who's no use of his limbs, mm-hmm. and he's basically just a head as well, except he possesses a physical body. So it's really interesting. Well, so she, head, where they're mean, having this.
Hawking is a brain. I mean,
yes, with nothing else.
Yeah. So, but Bill's response is, "What's done is done, and what's done is right." And then Kurt says, "Okay, I'll let you do your experiment of horror."
Yes.
And so now Bill has 48 hours to procure a body to affix his, girlfriend, fiance, whatever, to fix her head to this body to make her whole again.
Yeah.
Now, with the clock ticking...
With no patient compliance or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, okay, I'm doing this.
Yeah. With the clock ticking, you would think that he would just want a body, any body. But no, he's looking for a beautiful body.
Yes.
The perfect body.
And what better place to go than...
A burlesque house.
Yes.
And he tries to...
chat up, and he's on the make, as they put it, the 1960s jargon. Ergot, he's on the make with one of the principal dancers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's backstage trying to, you know, put the moves on her, mm-hmm. and she's rebuffing him initially, but again, this guy's a handsome Paul Newman type.
But then he decides that the burlesque dancer is not the right body for him. Meanwhile, back at the lab, Jan... The head in the pan, Jan in the pan, is developing some sort of telepathic abilities. And not just that, but there's another denizen of this lab. It's actually in the basement of the house. And it's this
where all the best labs are.
Yeah. It's this... We don't know. There's a locked door, and behind it is some sort of monster. Basically, Kurt says, it's the cumulative effect of all of Bill's mistakes. And the monster... is just there, kind of grunting and groaning, and Jan, who's just this head in the pan, is
communicating with him. Yeah,
and saying,
and he's communicating back like a horse, like tap one on the door for yes, tap two for no.
Yeah. Are you a monster like me? Tap. Boom. Are you deformed? Boom. Do you want revenge? Boom, boom, boom. It's yeah. So
and she's somehow communicating without the aid of a larynx. But that's fine. She's just a head. And
yeah.
Suspend your disbelief. Yeah. She's suspended in the fluid. So,
but yeah, I mean, she's not happy. She wants. She's at this point. She's starting to plot revenge. And
meanwhile, you'd think she would welcome a body to complete her. She's just a head.
But again, she's got no soul. She's just a head in a pen.
Hey, but if she had a body, she would have her life back, and she still is her soul.
But would it be her?
No, that's a good question. Yeah, I guess what part constitutes you?
Exactly.
Is there the Descartes, the Cartesian mind-body dualism?
Totally.
It makes me think of, what is it? Is it cryonics or cryogenics? I forget what it is, where you freeze your brain. And
cryogenics, yeah.
And then one, in the hopes of to 100 years, 200 years hence, they're able to thaw you out. Like some sort of,
like
frozen pizza.
Like what's reported to be with Walt Disney. They say that his brain is...
Yeah, or that there may be an urban legend, I think, yeah.
Yeah, well,
and
apocryphal.
Yeah, yeah, and then like a pizza pocket or some sort of, grocery store treat in the freezer. You're thawed out, and then they slap any body on you, and then you're whole again.
Yes.
With the assumption being that the organization you're paying to keep you frozen doesn't go, doesn't become insolvent and
but this is
leaves
a,
you
this
to
is
thought.
A, this is a philosophical dilemma,
mm-hmm.
because, I mean, if some people say, that, the sum total of your existence is within your brain, your memories.
I would think, yeah.
But, so therefore, ergo, you could take a brain and put it in any other body, it's still you. So, okay, here I am, my Jeff, right?
Yeah.
If my brain was implanted in you, Chris's body...
Scary thought, but yeah.
I know. I mean, I would not be. I don't think I would be Jeff anymore. I would have my experiences, but how I would, in terms of my memory,
and would be interpreted through me.
But how I now experience the world is through you. And
true.
And your relationship to your body, which is so different than my relationship to my body. And this is really, really, I mean, I studied this in philosophy in university.
Well, it's a common trope of science fiction, whether your brain and your associated memories would just be, could be just stored somewhere in a file or some sort of hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's how we will live on indefinitely rather than a physical body. So it's, who would have thought, like, a schlocky movie like this has so much, you know, it's imbued with so many interesting, so much interesting subtext.
Because really, I mean, a brain is a brain, but how we manipulate the world around us is through our body, you know? Yes, the body may be the vehicle, and the brain and the heart might be is like the gasoline, but all the same, you know, you still need that chassis, that body.
Yeah.
Right? But I think we're getting a little too profound for a movie such as this, because, you know, we have the good doctor going around. I mean, he didn't find what he wanted, the burlesque house, and then he finds an ex-paramour, and she invites him to a bikini contest, a Miss
Body
Beautiful contest. And there are about five women. We gotta say, in this movie, there's not many lookers.
No.
There's a lot of fugglies.
It's true.
But
perhaps so, intentionally.
But then one of the contestants, who we both say, hey, she's the best of the bunch, mm-hmm. right? The woman that brought him says, you know, she's got the second best body I've ever seen. And Bill goes, oh, next to yours? No. Next to, do you remember this, whatever her name is? Back in the day, you know, her name was actually Doris.
Yeah, a figure model.
Yeah, and now all she does is stay at home and model, and she never leaves the house. And,
and
there's a reason for that.
Yes, and this Doris, again, she's a figure model and she gets photographed by...
Well, this is
a camera club. And you were telling me, oh, that's very Betty Page-esque.
Yes,
like, expand on that. You're a huge Betty Page fan. Indeed. You've got a picture of her in your bathroom.
I've got two Betty Page tattoos. I've got autographs everywhere. I worship Betty Page. But camera clubs are a thing that went on in the 50s and 60s where hobbyists, enthusiasts,
i.e. perverts,
would pay these models to basically just stand there and pose, and they would snap pictures in order to further their craft of photography.
Get
the rocks off. And the reason why they're called camera clubs is because it wouldn't just be a one-on-one photography session. There'd be like 6, 7, 8 of them, and the model would just stand there and, you know, strike a pose, and just be snapping away. And Betty Page participated in a lot of these camera club sessions, so a lot of the images that we see nowadays of Betty Page came from these camera clubs.
Interesting.
So there's a camera club going on, and there's this model Doris, and she's got a body.
Definitely.
A nice body. And Bill thinks that, hey, this is the one. Now, again, I'm asking, man, like 48 hours, and then his brain's going to expire. Honestly, dude, just get a body. But he wants the perfect body,
hey,
you know?
Yeah.
Bit of irony is that Doris has a great body, there's something wrong with her face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess she's got a scar that's obscured by this sort of long, lustrous, flowing, dark hair.
Mm-hmm.
And she seems to be way more, I guess, obsessed with this physical, I guess, malformation, malady, mm-hmm. than really we are, because she's a gorgeous woman with long eyelashes and just gorgeous face, but it's this little thing on the side of her face that she wants to have fixed, although she's been to several doctors, none of whom have been able to help her.
The scar tissue is too deep.
Yes.
So, I mean, she spends her days being oogled by these camera club perverts who are asking her out and saying, you know, can we have private one-on-one sessions?
Or as the movie put it, being bare in front of a bunch of neurotics.
But she's just hermetic recluse because of this this little bit of a scar on her face.
Well, maybe Dr. Kottner can help her out.
Yes, indeed. And he basically convinces her to come back to his quote-unquote father's house where he will... who's supposed to be the best plastic surgeon in the world, when really what he wants to do is he wants her body to affix Jan's head to.
Yeah.
Now.
Like a bad Photoshop experiment that we've done on our site. Yeah.
Or back in the day, when it was the internet, it'd be like, you know, new picture of this celebrity.
Yeah.
You know, Jennifer Aniston, it would be like Jennifer Aniston's head like slapped on like some Playboy Playmate.
Yeah.
And some people actually bought that. You know?
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
But meanwhile, back at the lab, I mean, Jan is really developing a bit of a kinship with this monster behind the locked door.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Kurt comes down And Janet starts taunting him. And she's really, like, she's like an evil little bitch in that band. And she's taunting him and teasing him and calling him, like, a monster with his deformed hand. And she somehow gets him to unlock the little mini door within the door so that whatever's behind the,
Whatever's behind the door.
Whatever's behind the door is monster's arm reaches out and rips the doctor's arm off. And he goes through about 8 minutes of
and
incredible
8 quarts of blood.
Death throes. This is a black and white film. It was probably just paint of some sort. But it was fairly gory for its time, I gotta say. So when Bill comes back with Doris and he's all set to perform this operation, he notices that his colleague,
his assistant, has expired. Yep.
And he's ready at this point to do the operation. But Jan, who at this point is just crazy. I mean, she's cackling a la Margaret Hamilton in The Wizard of Oz. Yes. You know?
Yeah, she's goading him and baiting him, and to the point where he takes a piece of tape and slaps it over her mouth.
Exactly,
he can't take it.
Yeah. But all the same, she's able to communicate with the monster behind the closet, and he breaks through. And now this creature is awesome.
Yeah,
this is a cool ass creature. How would you describe this creature?
Few parts. A little bit of the Saturday Night Live sketch of Coneheads. Mixed with a little bit of Henan Lauder's Basket Case.
Well, no, because it's very interesting, because in Basket Case 3, as I said before, as you said, Frank Henenlotter loved this movie. Look, this movie, obviously Reanime or Stu Gordon must have taken a lot of influence from it as well. Mm-hmm. Henenlotter designed a creature in Basket Case 3 after that creature behind the door in The Brain That Wouldn't Die. So,
yeah, with an eyeball askew and a conical head, you know, 6-7 frame, deformed, oversized, disproportionate hands. It's a pretty neat creature for the time.
Totally, totally. And, I mean, the lab catches on fire, she's cackling away, Bill expires, and then the monster picks up the beauty, Doris, and absconds with her. So it's...
The damsel and the monster,
So, I mean, and that's basically the end of The Brain That Wouldn't Die, but, I mean... this movie, I don't know, like, it's very interesting, because a lot of people, anytime anything has been Mystery Science Theater 3000, people will automatically dismiss it as crap. This is another movie that's been in the public domain for a while. There's a lot of really shitty, shoddy prints out there. I just got on Blu-ray, beautiful, pristine transfer. This is a movie that a lot of people just sort of think, you know, there's nothing much to it. It's just a drive-in, you know, second feature. But it's a fun movie. When I first saw it, I was quite shocked at how ahead, you know, of its time it was. I mean, what's that line about leaping science?
Is it a crime for science to jump ahead by years?
Mm-hmm. I was surprised by some of these moral questions about science and the limits of man and doctors and, you know, ethics and what they could do versus what they should do.
This is frequently the domain of schlocky sci-fi this. This is where you can ask these questions.
Mm-hmm. I love the mad scientist movies. Mm-hmm. I know. I mean, whether it's Dr. Fibes, Dr. Caligari, whether it's Dr. Herbert West,
Dr. Pretorius,
even Seth Brundle on the Fly. I love the mad scientist genre. I loved the gore. I mean, there's a little bit of gore in this. I love the monster in the closet. There's so much, and I love the hokiness of the dialogue, the stilted wooden acting. I love the image of the woman in the pan, just getting more and more evil and cackling away, and the
authority figures and the hubristic, bone saws there getting their comeuppance, because they're widely acknowledged, along with lawyers, to be some of the more arrogant, you know, professionally arrogant people around, and thinking that they are gods. Mm-hmm.
And just the haunting refrain of kill me, kill me, kill me. I mean, that's kind of disturbing, you know?
Yeah.
So this movie, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I really dig it. And, you know, getting back to the morality question about hubristic, I mean, Dr. Cordner, I mean, throughout the movie, there's nothing sympathetic about him. You know, he never shows one shred of sympathy, humanity. He's hubristic from the beginning to the end. He feels that everything he's doing is right. He doesn't question for a second his motives or his motivations or what have you. Despite the protestations of his lover, he's like, look, I'm going to put your head on a body, and that's the end of that. You know, you're going to like it. What's done is done, and what's done is right. And, I mean, that question resonates today. Because we still have debates in the world of medical science, be it stem cell research, be it cloning, be it...
End-of-life issues. And if someone's suffering, who has the right to end their life? And, yeah.
Yep.
Interesting case here locally, Robert Latimer, who, if I'm not mistaken, I guess smothered his own daughter, who was paralyzed and was deaf and blind and had all these maladies and afflictions. And so who decides ultimately? Is it... One would hope, I forget who said the quote, but philosophy is just a means of dealing with death. So who really is in charge of your existence? You as an autonomous being should mm-hmm. be the one to make that call. But unfortunately, if you were to get into some sort of accident and you haven't, made any sort of arrangements mm-hmm. whereby a next of kin or a spouse would make that decision for you, who does? Mm-hmm. And would you want to be kept alive, like strung up to this, in some sort of weird, mysterious fluid or hooked mm-hmm. up to machines or whatnot?
Do you remember the Terry Schiavo case from a few years back?
Yes.
That was a pretty interesting one, and then all the right to life people came out and said, no, only God can...
And to lower the tone considerably, also a Metallica video.
Oh, One.
Called One.
Well, that's the thing, man. Yeah. When I saw that video as a kid, and that movie, that video, what they would do is they would intersperse the performance footage of Metallica back when they were fucking awesome band, mm-hmm. right? And, really cool black and white performance videos, footage, interspersed with clips from a movie called Johnny Got His Gun, which is based on a novel by Dalton Trumbo. And it was about a guy who, in World War I, who stepped on a landmine and basically just was living as a torso. And he wanted to die. And
Kill me.
Yeah, and then he would only be able to communicate through Morse code. You heard his internal monologue. I have not seen this movie. Why have I not seen this movie? Because that video traumatized the shit out of me as a kid. And I had nightmares for a decade, okay?
Yeah, and famously, it was One, and mm-hmm. it was Metallica's One video, because mm-hmm. they had come up as a touring act, and they had no exposure to MTV mm-hmm. prior to this, and
They were even asked to do a second video with just performance footage, because it was so disturbing. I remember when I finally watched a video, maybe 10 years later, on the Power Hour, and I felt so brave, I finally watched it, and I actually really want to see Johnny Got His Gun. But yeah, you were talking about that, I sort of interrupted you, because you brought up a childhood memory, but... The video for One had that same sort of thing. I mean, there was a man being kept alive. It's just a torso. I mean, he couldn't do anything except nod his head, and say, in Morse code, kill me.
Which is even more than, let's say, someone in the advanced throes or stages of Alzheimer's can do, where they're not, again, they're a brain, but their brain has forgotten everything, and they're just being kept alive. Their body may be in perfectly good health, but their brain has... nothing.
Landmine! What? And stick in my sight! Stick in my
hearing! God, we go from John Cougar Mellencamp to Metallica. What has this
podcast... Left me this lifeless game!
What hath this podcast wrought? Yeah. So... If you have no memories, then what good is your brain if you're just a body? And what good is your body if you're just a brain?
And what came first, the chicken or the egg? And if a tree falls in the forest, is anyone here?
On the surface, on this patina, schlocky, goofy, ridiculous mad scientist,
drive-in fair.
A drive-in schlock with tons of questions bubbling beneath the surface.
But
chemical in a beaker.
On the other hand, if you're not one who likes to look for subtext and that and questions, it's just a fun, schlocky head in a pan movie. So I mean, when we talk about what did we learn, I think we discussed quite a bit about what we learned as far as philosophical questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, does the brain rule the body? Does the body rule the brain? Et cetera, et cetera. Is there anything else you learned from this flick?
I learned that I guess you can just fool the average viewer by just removing a head from from the scene of an accident without them knowing it's actually their head. And you mentioned it to me after you pointed this out, what the principal character was doing, but Jane Mansfield.
Yeah.
Lost her head in a car accident.
Yeah, because you're like, what happened? Did her head just get decapitated? I'm like, yeah, man, it happens. Jane Mansfield. was decapitated in a car accident.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and what a body, James Madfield, to tie things all together.
See, what I would have done is, if I was Dr. Corner, I would have taken Jane Mansfield's body away.
Hey, you could also use Jane Mansfield's head, you know, depending on what condition it was in. Hey, if you're transplanting heads onto bodies, presumably you can take a brain, stick it into a head. Yeah. This Dr. Kottner was way ahead of its time. His time. Yeah, and earlier on we were talking about, you know, the movie Crash,
mm-hmm.
where David Cronenberg, where in it there was a historical reenactor who got his jollies from reenacting famous fatal crashes from, you know, involving Hollywood James icons like one, James Dean. Yep. Yeah, so, again, a lot of weirdness. Jane Mansfield lost her head in an accident. Well, and so did Jan, and Jan had no designs on living on with someone else's body. So mm-hmm. she was able to, she was able to have some sort of, her moral compass was not misaligned despite having just a head, and she did not want to go on living with someone else's body.
Mm-hmm.
Although, one wonders, whether she would have felt differently had they been able to use some sort of, or reanimate some sort of dead body that was previously dead and just used for that purpose rather than going out and purposely killing a body to use for her. Her moral principles intact, she wanted to go out. She wanted to kill herself and not live on in any capacity.
But, you know, you talk about morality, she also wanted revenge and she wanted to...
yeah, very
know,
true.
Yeah, she wanted
conflicted
her,
morality. Yeah,
she
yeah.
wanted her... ex-lover to suffer for what he did to her. So.
Yes, interesting. Another issue to, you know.
Yeah. So there's a lot going on in this movie. Star rating?
Probably 3 for me.
Yeah.
A little bit of pacing here and there.
Yeah,
and it's interesting. There's lots of film noir interludes involving dark bars and burlesque women and... Dr. Kottner laying on his heavy-handed charm mm-hmm. and lots of saxophone and interesting, but again, this was only 80 minutes long, so a few lulls could be forgiven in the context of everything else it offered. So,
like
yeah, 3 for me.
For a movie that when I first saw, I had the lowest of expectations, considering that this was basically, you know, the second feature on the drive-in bill, probably playing with something like, you know, Vincent Price, AIP movie or something. And I was extremely surprised by what I got, and entertained, and of course, just surprised by a lot of it. When I saw that monster, I was like, damn, that's a good looking monster. good looking.
Yeah, for sure.
I really dig this movie, so I'm going to give it 3.5 stars.
For its lasting influencing the likes of Stu Gordon and Frank Henenlotter for these movies that we absolutely love, mm-hmm. whether it be Reanimator, From Beyond, Basket Case, what have you.
Yeah.
Obviously, when they were growing up, this was the kind of thing that they were really into, and
mm-hmm.
kind of a neat neat film, and the mad scientist genre has sort of fallen out of favor, despite these huge advances in recombinant DNA and genomic technology and that, so maybe we'll see a revival.
Well, see, that I think the reason why the mad scientist genre has fallen out of favor is because what was once considered mad is now considered normal.
Mm-hmm.
See, the mad scientist has now become...
normalized.
The normalized scientist. I mean, what can you do now?
Yeah, that's face graft, mm-hmm. Which was recently done, and very convincingly, when, you know, 20 years ago it would have been in the John Travolta vehicle, Nick Cage, face off.
Yep.
And then, you know, they go from transplanting dog organs in the turn of the century, last century, 1900s, to doing everything, and the sky's the limit in terms of what medical science can do.
Mm-hmm. But what should they do?
That's the question. For sure.
I may not approve of your methods, but I'm proud of your results.
Yes.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
Well, you know what you might need approve of is our website.
Yes, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. We're part of the Crypt TV family, and definitely follow us on Twitter, awful_movies, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Thank you.